Welcome to Christchurch Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com.
Many of you here will have had a job interview at some point. And if you've been in a job interview, you know that it's a relatively complex situation, isn't it? It's where you're sat there and you're wanting to give the best possible impression of yourself, your own experience, your own abilities. That's what you're trying to do. But at the same time, you are trying to work out what they want from you. So you're trying to think, okay, I'll give the best version of myself, but also I'll give trying to give the version of myself that is most desirable to my potential employer. So you're trying to work out what they want to hear and what they want, and it all becomes a little bit cloak and dagger as you try and do that. Also, you're trying to work out whether you actually want to work for them. So you're in this interview, you're thinking, are you just an HR person, or are you actually going to be my boss? Do I like you? Or is it possible that we can work in the same office? All of these things you're trying to work out. And then they're throwing in difficult questions at you to try and expose you in some way. So the classic question that always comes is, tell me about one of your weaknesses and how you overcame it. So, and it's not a direct question, is it? They're not saying, tell us how you binge on Netflix and waste a whole weekend. They're not asking you about those sort of weaknesses, are they? What they want you to do is actually to show some self-awareness, show some humility, and also show that you are good at teamwork. That's what they want you to show with that question, but they're not telling you that. It's all hidden in the subtext there. And really, it's a complex thing. And you're trying not to give too much away in case you kind of take them down the wrong path thinking about you whilst you're trying to learn things as well. And we all know in our kind of work life, we've all worked with people who are brilliant at interviews. Okay, brilliant at them, but not very good at their job. And you know when they go for the interview, you think, oh, you're going to get the promotion because you're really good at interviews, but you're not very good at your job. But you also know people, absolute rubbish at interviews, but brilliant what they do. There was a girl in an office I used to work in who just knew the job inside out, knew the whole kind of processes of this government organisation we worked for. She was very good at it. But whenever she went into an interview situation, she became instantly hostile and so never got promoted. But you knew that other people were getting promoted above her who weren't as good as what she did. So it's a difficult and complex situation. And actually, being questioned and put under pressure is something we need to learn to deal with in life, and also knowing that the right questions can reveal a great deal to us. And so this morning we're going to look at actually how Jesus came under some significant questioning, aggressive questions that intended to trap him and to shame him. And actually, these questions that Jesus faced revealed a great deal, although they weren't the things that the questioners wanted to reveal. So this morning we're going to see Jesus is asked about paying tax, about what happens to your marriage after you die, and what is the greatest commandment. Okay, he's asked these three questions. And Jesus uses these questions, actually, to talk about much bigger, much deeper things. So he uses these questions to talk about our identity, to talk about his revolutionary plan, and then also to talk about our behavior. And he uses these questions to see that there's actually numbers of bits of subtext underneath that he is going to teach on. And so we're going to think about these things today. We're going to work our way through. We're going to read big chunks of Bible. We're going to work through some pretty deep stuff, and we're going to do it quite quickly. So stick with me. So, we have been reading Mark, we've been working all the way through since January this year, and actually, me, Vic and the family, we're going to move to Gorton in January and start leading there, and you lot's still going to be working through Mark, that's all I'm saying. And you're going to enjoy it, it's your privilege, you'll get to work through it up until March. Andy tells me he's going to carry on doing it, which is very good. So, in this point, Mark has told the story of Jesus. He's taken us through the countryside with Jesus towards Jerusalem. And it really is his journey towards Jerusalem. And in chapter 11, he gets to Jerusalem, which is the heart of Israel's politics, its culture, religious life, commercial life. And then he goes to the very heart of Jerusalem, which is the temple, which is really where all of this stuff happens. And Jesus gets there and then just sets off fireworks. So he turns over the tables of the moneylenders. He turns over the tables of people selling animals for sacrifice. And this was a deeply significant act. Up until this point, Jesus is a guy in the countryside who they don't understand and they're a bit nervous of. And when he gets there, he's then attempting to turn over their whole religious system. Now he's a real problem. You're welcome. He is upsetting the most powerful people in Israel, which are the chief priests and the scribes. So those people he is upsetting, particularly turning over moneylenders, getting rid of people who are selling animals. He's cutting off their revenue stream. If you want to annoy someone, take away their ability to earn money. They are now working out how to arrest him and kill him. How do we get rid of this bloke? So they send a few different people to ask Jesus some questions. And these questions are revealing. So like I've said, they're going to reveal what he thinks about our identity, reveal his plan, and reveal also what he kind of expects from us behavior-wise. So we're going to look at these three questions. And question one is, should I pay tax? Okay. So let's read what happens, how this question happens. And we're in Mark 12, 13 to 34. Yeah, there it is there. It says, and they sent him to some of the Pharisees, and they sent some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians to trap him in his talk. And they came and said to him, teacher, we know you are true and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances, but teach truly the way of God. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay them or should we not? But knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, why put me to the test? Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. And they brought one, and he said to them, whose likeness and inscription is this? And they said to him, Caesar's. And Jesus said to them, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they marveled at him. So there is a lot going on in this passage, so let's just skip our way through. Firstly, the Pharisees and the Herodians, they turn up together. It's important to note that because they hate each other. They do, the Pharisees were all about the purity and independence of Israel as a nation. They were real nationalists that wanted to see the nation restored to its former glory. The Herodians were, well, they were King Herod's people, and King Herod's people were pretty happy having the Romans around because the Romans made them rich. Put them at the top of society. So these two groups, one that is probably quite anti-Roman and one is probably quite pro-Roman, are working together to get Jesus. So they form some sort of unholy alliance. And they say, we're going to trap him in his talk, which literally means they're going to try and catch him like an animal. That's what they are out to do to Jesus. And so they suck up to him. They say, you are true. You don't care about others' opinions. You aren't swayed by appearance. Truly you teach the way of God. So they're trying to butter him up and be kind and nice to him. But actually, they have revealed themselves very quickly. And Jesus sees it. And it's easy to spot a legalist because they are obsessed with religious detail. And these two are. So he sees their hypocrisy. And so they ask this question, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay them or should we not? And so the trap is pretty simple as they have set it. If he says, yeah, pay taxes to Rome, then the people around him who are longing for a Messiah, and they see the Messiah as this person who will restore Israel to its former glory, will be a king like David. The geographical area of Israel will be restored. The Romans will be driven out. He will be the physical king of Israel. But if he says, pay taxes to Rome, then they're thinking, oh, he's not that guy. He's not that Messiah. If he says, don't pay taxes to Rome, then the Romans will be quite annoyed about that, will arrest him and kill him for being a revolutionary, which they were quite comfortable doing. So they want to trap him between these two positions. But Jesus is wiser than them and beats the trap. So, and in doing so, he actually reveals something much deeper than paying taxes to Rome. We read this today and think, well, what does it matter to us whether they pay taxes to Romans or not? Actually, Jesus is revealing a much deeper point. He's revealing, actually, he isn't there to beat the Romans. He isn't there to do that. He's there, actually, to beat sin, to beat death, and to call people back to their true purpose, their true identity. And so how does he make that point? Well, he asks for a coin. That's interesting. He doesn't have one of these coins, but the people that are asking questions do. So even in that moment, saying, look, I don't have any money on me. Oh, you people who are doing very well off the Romans, you must have a coin. And they bring out a coin, a Roman coin. And this coin in itself is a very complicated object because it's Roman. And on this coin, there is a picture of Caesar Tiberius, it was at the time. And on that coin, it also had the inscription, Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus. In other words, Caesar, the son of God, written on this coin. So they are stood in the temple. And remember, in this temple, it is forbidden to have any idols, any image of gods whatsoever, or any gods. And actually, a few hundred years earlier, when Israel was invaded by another nation, one of the things they did to kind of subjugate the Israelites was to put up a big statue of their own god in the temple. It was massively offensive. So even having this coin with this picture on it of this person who claims some sort of divine godness is wrong. Is offensive. Someone who claimed even to be the son of God. So as Jesus is holding this, I think everybody listening gets the irony, feels the tension. Okay, this is a dangerous moment. They're trying to catch Jesus out with politics and religion, which is never a good mix, and they're going at him at the same time. So Jesus says, whatever is Caesar's, this is Caesar's, he's got his picture on it, just give to Caesar. And the things that are God's, we give to God. Now, as Mark writes this story, I think he means us to remember something that was said a few chapters earlier when Jesus and Peter are talking. And when Jesus says to Peter, look, you get behind me, Satan, for you have not set your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. There's something very similar in just how the words are laid out. Actually, he is saying to these people, look, your minds are on the things of men. You're thinking about earthly things. You're not thinking about godly things. You are focused on wealth. You are focused on power. You're not having your eyes to heaven. And actually, Jesus has his eyes on much bigger things. So because of that, I'm happy for Caesar to keep his money. It's not a problem to me. He can have his money. Pay taxes to Caesar. If that's where he thinks there's power, he can have it. His eyes are on something much bigger. So as well as this coin, which has the image, or this idea of an image of God, there's actually something else there which has the image of God too, and that is humans. So in Genesis it says God created man in his own image. So actually the image of God is often in the temple because humans go there. They go there to worship him, they go there to represent him, and they go out in the world to do the same thing. So Jesus says, look, Caesar can have his money, but I'm here for all of you. That's who I'm here for. I'm here to restore you to your actual purpose, to be God's image in the world, to be God's image in creation, to be God's image in this great temple that he has built. He is there to restore humans back to God. So the issue of do we pay taxes to this enemy force, actually it's like, look, I'm here for you. I'm here for us to go back to God, to find our true purpose, to remember actually we are made in his image to live for him. That's the most important thing here. And so in that moment, we just give to Caesar what's his. We lay down our power. We lay down our desire for wealth. We give ourselves to God. So then question one, Jesus actually, okay, let's remember our true purpose, our true identity. And so you imagine the Pharisees and the Herodians kind of slinking off at this moment. And then another group appear. And they ask a question about marriage after death. You think, oh, that's a strange question. Well, it gets stranger. So let's read in verse 18. And the Sadducees came to him, and the Sadducees say there is no resurrection. And they ask him a question, saying, teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife, but leaves no child, the man must take the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. And there were seven brothers. The first took a wife, and then he died, leaving no offspring. And the second took her and died, leaving no offspring. And the third likewise. And the seven left no offspring. Last of all, the woman also died. In the resurrection, when they rise again, whose wife shall she be? For the seven had her as a wife. And Jesus said to them, is this not the reason you are wrong? Because you know neither the scriptures nor the power of God. For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And as for the dead being raised, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the passage about the bush, how God spoke to him, saying, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. You are quite wrong. Again, just stacks going on in this passage, so we'll bounce our way through. And again, they're trying to catch Jesus out. They are trying to trap him like the animal. They're trying to chase him and catch him. And very simply, this group, the Sadducees, don't believe in the resurrection. And they don't believe in it. The Pharisees did. It's because they only read the first five books of what we would call the Old Testament. They only read the Pentateuch. They didn't read anything else. So they wouldn't touch Psalms, Proverbs, anything else. Isaiah, Ezekiel, all of these places where we see stories and hints of resurrection, they wouldn't read it, they wouldn't touch it. They are hugely religiously conservative. So what we would call the Old Testament, some of it they thought was too new and up to date. They don't want to touch it. So they are very conservative crowds. And so they invent this story. Based on Jewish law, if a man's brother dies, then this man must marry his widow if he has no children. It was deliberate to be able to look after widows, people who maybe would lose their ability to earn a living, maybe lose help for their children, so they would stay as part of the wider family. It was meant to look after them, so it was a good thing. But they spin it out into this crazy story where this poor woman loses seven husbands as she works her way through the brothers. They keep dying. And they're effectively just saying, look, isn't resurrection all a little bit silly? Because life is complicated. Who would actually she be married to? Would she be married to all seven of them? Isn't this just a little bit ridiculous? You think, okay, well, why does this matter, firstly? Why does it matter to us today? Thousands of years later, we don't have this law. We don't have these problems. Although we do think, actually, I wonder what happens when we die? What happens to the relationships that we have now? So Sadducees, like we said, they are massively conservative and mainstream. They work closely with the priests and the scribes. They are very happy with the situation politically. They are happy with the Romans really kind of being in charge as an occupying force because they're very powerful. They're quite rich. They have become influential. They are at the top of society. They quite like their position. Thank you very much. And so they don't want resurrection to be accepted theology. That's bad news for them. Well, why is that? Well, if we think about resurrection for a moment, just properly, if you expect and believe and live knowing that God will bring you back to life again and God will resurrect you, then you would probably live your life a little bit differently now, wouldn't you? You might actually look at the way you live and think, I'm not going to live for wealth and power. I'm not going to allow myself to be dominated. I'm going to live in the right way. I'm going to live for God. I'm not going to live to keep other people in power. Actually, I'm going to live for Jesus. I'm going to live for the King. I'm not living for you people. So resurrection undermines the status quo. Resurrection is bad for people at the top. If you believe that God will bring you back from the dead, actually, you live for Him, you don't live for the world, and you're not so worried about dying. You're not so worried that in a revolution you might have to stand up and die. And so that makes society much more unsettled for the Sadducees. So Jesus tells them, look, you don't believe in the power of God. You don't believe that God is a life bringer. You don't believe that. You don't believe He has eternity in His hands. You don't believe that He's going to remake the world. You don't believe He will resurrect all of you. So when He says, look, in your Pentateuch, it says the God of Abraham, He is the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. He's saying, look, He is those people's God, the God of the living, because He is going to resurrect Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. He is the God, not of the dead, but of the living. And actually, suddenly Jesus kind of opens out his revolutionary plan. And it's much more deep and profound than the Sadducees or the Pharisees or the chief priests think. They think, oh, does he want to be king? He wants to get rid of us and he wants to have the wealth and influence. Actually, he's saying, no, I'm coming here in a revolution, but I'm coming to defeat death and to defeat sin. And actually, I'm coming to bring eternal life, which changes everything. It changes how you live your life now. He is saying, look, I'm calling you to lift your eyes from this world, this kingdom, your kingdom, and look to my kingdom, and to live with eternity in mind. And actually, when that's true, when we think, okay, I believe in Jesus, I believe that he came back from the dead, I believe that Jesus is alive today, nearly 2020 in Manchester, I believe Jesus is alive. I believe also that he's brought me back to life. He's removed me from sin and death. And I also believe that he will resurrect me again in the future. And I'll live in the new heaven and the new earth. That's what we believe as we read the New Testament. Actually, that then changes how we play out our lives now, doesn't it? That changes how we live. And that is unsettling for the powers. And then Jesus gets to the third question. So we've had